Stella Gibbons was born in London 1902. She went to the North London Collegiate School and studied journalism at University College London. She then worked for 10 years on various papers, including the Evening Standard. Stella Gibbons is the author of 25 novels, 3 volumes of short stories, and 4 volumes of poetry. Her first novel, Cold Comfort Farm, 1932, was an immediate success and won her the Femina V. Harousse Prize in 1933. Among her works are Nightingale Wood, 1938, The Bachelor, 1944, Westwood, 1946, and Starlight, 1967. She was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 1950. Stella Gibbons died in 1989. Debbie's in the studio with me. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning.
And we're reviewing Stella Gibbons' Cold Comfort Farm, which I really, really enjoyed.
Yes, me too. It was delightful, wasn't it? A really good feel-good novel. Mm. But make no mistake, it's been very well written, hasn't it?
Fantastically written. Yeah, really, really good. Very uplifting, very funny. I just enjoyed it the whole way through. I was laughing quite a lot.
Yes.
It's a delight. And it's written in a style it's very rich in its language, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So in the foreword, Stella Gibbons writes to a fictitious author and states her intent by saying that she's a journalist and she's used to writing plain language. And now she's written this novel, and this novel is quite the opposite.
Yeah, and it made me think that I think there are quite a few authors, particularly children's authors, who have gone from journalism to writing novels. Mm. And obviously I write, and I write paper articles, and I write plays. And it got me thinking that really both of those are very concise forms of writing, because when you're writing a play, you have to write as people speak. You can't just go off on
That's a good point, for a long time and
explore one's feelings, or if you do, it's probably not very dramatic. So I think I would struggle writing a novel. So I think she's done ever so well.
Yeah, that's really an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it like that. As you say, as a journalist, do you have to be quite succinct? Do you have to get to the point quite quickly?
You do.
You don't want to lose your readers, and equally with a play. So the story begins with Flora, who's been orphaned at 19 years old. Both her parents have died in quick succession. And she has a friend who she stays with in London.
Mrs. Smiling.
Mrs. Smiling, who's a lovely Irish lady. And Mrs. Smiling says to Flora, what are you going to do now? How are you going to support yourself?
That's right. And she says that she certainly doesn't intend to work. That doesn't seem to interest her at all. But she does like organising things, and she's decided to basically be a sponger.
Yeah, she goes through all her relatives, and she writes to them all, doesn't she? Declaring that she's an orphan, and can they put her up for a bit? And she gets a letter from her relatives in Cold Comfort Farm, which is based in Sussex, and they invite her to go and stay. And that's when she arrives and discovers that the farm is in a poor state, and that the relatives are all slightly odd.
They are odd. And they're happy for her to go and stay because they say that her father had been wronged.
That's right.
By one of the relatives who has died. Yes. So they feel they are obliged to give her her dues. So she's also, throughout this novel, she's trying to find out what the wrong was.
Yes. Yes, and what's due to her as well.
Yes.
And she's referred to throughout the novel as Robert Postchild. They never seem to get their heads around calling her Flora. Yes, she lives there, and the more we discover about the family, and they're all slightly strange in some way. One of the more odd characters is Flora's cousin Judith, who seems to be unusually melancholy, but also has a strange obsession with her son Seth. Let's listen to an excerpt from the audiobook.
Flora rapped at Judith's bedroom door, and in reply to a muttered, "Come in," entered. 200 photographs of Seth, aged from 6 weeks to 24 years, decorated the walls of Judith's bedroom. She sat by the window in a soiled red dressing gown with a dirty pack of cards on the table in front of her. The bed was not made. Her hair hung about her face, a nest of lifeless black snakes. "Good morning," said Flora. "I'm so sorry to interrupt you if you are busy writing letters. I just wanted to know if you would like me to amuse myself and make my own arrangements, or would you like me to come in and see you about this time every morning? Personally, I think it's much easier if a guest wanders round and finds her own ways of passing the time. I'm sure you are far too busy to want to bother with looking after me." Judith, after a long stare at her young cousin, flung back her head with its load of snakes. The raw air splintered before the harsh onslaught of her laugh. Busy, busy weaving my own shroud, belike. Nay, do what you please, Robert Postchild, if so be as you don't break in on my loneliness. Give me time, and I will atone for the wrong my man did your father. Give us all time.
She very quickly uses her organisational skills to sort the farm out.
Yes.
But it's not always straightforward. There are lots of challenges.
Absolutely. She refers to a book called The Higher Common Sense. But mostly she's quite instinctive about the family and she understands how their minds work.
So Aunt Ada is a bit off her trolley, having seen something nasty in the woodshed when she was a child.
Which gets repeated throughout the book, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, you could say it can be done different ways, can't it? But the way the version was read that I listened to, she very much was presented as a malingering old fool who was using the fact that she saw something nasty in the woodshed to get out of anything. And she wants to keep everyone, every relative, at Cold Comfort Farm. And if anyone tries to go out for the day, she says, oh, I saw something nasty in the woodshed. Yes. And they're like, oh, no, we mustn't upset her. We have to stay where we are.
Yes.
So she's quite a manipulative old witch, really, isn't she?
Absolutely. And doesn't come out of her room and serves several meals a day.
Yeah.
And keeps them all on a very tight leash. Mm. Even so, they're not even allowed to go to the market town and they have to sneak about
yes.
so that they don't upset Aunt Ada, who sounds absolutely horrific.
Let's just pause here and hear an excerpt from the book when Aunt Ada describes her own predicament.
Aunt Ada Doom sat in her room upstairs alone. There was something almost symbolic in her solitude. She was the core, the matrix, the focusing point of the house, and she was, like all cores, utterly alone. You never heard of two cores to a thing, did you? Well then. Yet all the wandering waves of desire, passion, jealousy, lust that throbbed through the house converged, web-like, upon her core solitude. She felt herself to be a core, and utterly, irrevocably alone. The weakening winds of spring fawned against the old house. The old woman's thoughts cowered in the hot room where she sat in solitude. She would not see her niece. Keep her away. Make some excuse. Shut her out. She had been here a month and you had not seen her. She thought it strange, did she? She dropped hints that she would like to see you. You did not want to see her. You felt some strange emotion at the thought of her. You would not see her. Your thoughts wound slowly round the room like beasts, rubbing against the drowsy walls. And outside the walls, the winds rub like drowsy beasts. Halfway between the inside and the outside walls, winds and thoughts were both drowsy. How enervating was the warm wind of the coming spring. When you were very small, so small that the lightest puff of breeze blew your little crinoline skirt over your head, you had seen something nasty in the woodshed. You'd never forgotten it. You'd never spoken of it to Mama. You could smell, even to this day, the fresh betel nut with which her shoes were always cleaned, but you'd remembered all your life. That was what had made you different. That, what you had seen in the tall shed, had made your marriage a prolonged nightmare to you. Somehow, you had never bothered about what it had been like for your husband. That was why you had brought your children into the world with loathing. Even now, when you were 79, you could never see a bicycle go past your bedroom window without a sick plunge at the apex of your stomach. In the bicycle shed you'd seen it, something nasty, when you were very small. That was why you stayed here in this room. You had been here for 20 years, ever since Judith had married and her husband had come to live at the farm.
So, yes, there's Aunt Ada and then there's Amos is the preacher.
Now, Amos is a very interesting character, isn't he?
He is, yes.
So he's a farmer, But he likes to tell everyone that they're doomed and that they need to mend their ways. And in the end, Flora, who likes sorting things out, has taken it upon herself very early on in the novel. Yes. I think the first thing she does is to encourage Amos to do a national tour of his preachings, just to get him out of the way, to let Reuben have control of the farm.
He goes to the States eventually. Yeah. He goes to America, yeah. I mean, she appeals to him. He's this fire and brimstone preacher, isn't he?
Yes.
And you're all going to hell and there's no retribution for anyone. And there's a scene in the chapel where he starts telling his congregation, and it all sounds very grim. I think Flora sneaks out the back.
Yeah.
Amos is the first person she removes from the farm because she can understand that the farm would run better without him.
I think at this point it's worth pausing for an excerpt from the audiobook when we hear Amos's particular style of preaching.
Flora detected a note of complacency and took her opportunity. I am looking forward so much to hearing you, Cousin Amos. I suppose you like preaching very much.
Nay, 'tis a fearful torment and a groaning to my soul's marrow, corrected Amos.
Like all true artists, thought Flora, he was unwilling to admit that he got no end of a kick out of his job.
But 'tis my mission. I must tell the brethren to prepare in time for torment, when the roaring red flames will lick around their feet like the dogs licking Jezebel's blood in the good book. I must tell everybody.
And here he moved slightly round in his seat, and Flora presumed that he was fixing her with a meaning stare.
Of hellfire, aye. The word burns in me mouth, and I must blow it out on the whole world like flames.
You ought to preach to a larger congregation than the brethren, suggested Flora, suddenly struck by a very good idea. You mustn't waste yourself on a few miserable sinners in Bearshawn, you know. Why don't you go round the country with a Ford van, preaching on market days? For she was sure that Amos's religious scruples were likely to be in the way when she began to introduce the changes she desired to bring about at the farm, and if she could get him out of the way on a long preaching tour, the task would be simpler.
I'm until the field nearest my hand, before I go into the hedges and byways, retorted Amos austerely. Besides, 'twould be exalting myself and puffing myself up if I was to go preaching all over the country in one of they Ford vans. 'Twould be thinking of my own glory instead of the glory of the Lord.
Flora was surprised to find him so astute, but reflected that religious maniacs always derived considerable comfort from digging into their motives for their actions and discovering discreditable reasons which covered them with good, satisfying sinfulness in which they could wallow to their heart's content. She thought she heard a note of wistfulness, however, in the words, one of the Ford vans, and gathered that the idea of such a tour tempted him considerably. She returned to the attack.
I think both of us picked up on the point that it's a parody, although you don't have to get involved with the parody to enjoy the book.
No.
I mean, the criticism and all the literary reviews I've read state that she was parodying D.H. Lawrence and possibly Thomas Hardy, who wrote those very kind of like rural...
Definitely Hardy. I've read a lot of Hardy, I would say so. And also the Brontes.
Yes, there's a touch of Wuthering Heights in there, isn't there?
Yeah, sort of... in fact, there's this wonderful... There's an interesting character. It's Mr. Meyerbug.
Yes.
Who is, he's certainly a writer, isn't he?
He's a writer, yes, an academic, yeah.
And he's writing, I mean, it's not giving anything away to say this, but he's writing a great work on the idea that Bramwell Bronte wrote all the books and all his sisters were drunkards, whereas I think we're pretty sure it was the other way around. So there were just little nods like that all the way through. Jane Austen,
Jane Austen quite a lot.
There's definitely something of that in there.
Very much so. And when Flora's being introduced to us, she's just like Emma from Emma, Jane Austen's Emma, you know, quite interfering, quite opinionated.
I mean, to be honest, Molly, when it started, I didn't like her very much.
First of all, yes, she doesn't want to work.
Yeah,
she wants to live
on, the sisterhood, you're letting us down.
I thought, what an interfering bossy boot she is. Yeah. And I was like you. I really didn't like her at first. I think she's sort of kind of presumptuous to think that she could go into a family's life and change the routine they've had and to sort of come around to her way of thinking, which is quite presumptuous and quite rude. But it's not about that. As you read further on, she's never condescending.
No, she's never rude.
She's never rude or condescending. She's always extremely polite. And I think that sense that she can see how things could be better, and then she tries to make them better without sort of upsetting anyone. And so should we go to our three reasons for listening to this wonderful audiobook?
Well, number one, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's easy to read and it's fun. It's not sort of a lowest common denominator book either. You know, this is a really good piece of writing. It's about 100 years old. It stood the test of time. It's a really, really fun book. Number two, I would say the characters. And number three, the names.
Yeah, the names are quite extraordinary and very funny. I'd agree with all of those. I like the sense of humour. It's quite naughty in some ways, but also really great fun. You don't have to necessarily know the works of D.H. Lawrence or Thomas Hardy to read it at all.
You don't.
And it stands alone in its own right.
It's a complete book, and it's got a nice little plot as well.
A nice plot, great drawn characters, beautiful language, and it's sort of uplifting. And
yes, that's the word. It is uplifting.
Yeah. One of those really sort of, you'd go back to and read it again and again. If you were feeling a little bit down, maybe you go and read it because it is such good fun and a delight the whole way through. I would highly recommend getting to Calibre and downloading this book if you get the chance. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Not at all. Thank you.
Special thanks to Calibre Audio for the kind permission to use the excerpts from the audiobook. If you'd like to listen to this book, contact Calibre Audio on 01 296 432 339. Their services are free to the visually impaired.